Okay. Is there some time for questions, comments?
I was just reflecting a little bit on going back to just offer to put it really simply. You know, if somebody is nice to me, I love them. But if they're not nice to me, I don't like them. So reflecting, kind of reflecting on that, and so how do we know if we really do care about this person? And, you know, just trying to reflect on that. There's somewhere in the middle there, I guess, I don't know, but it's just interesting how much that seems to be so prevalent in my life all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're always judging people, aren't we? On the basis of how we think they make us feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to just even set that down, yeah, because you say, well, how am I going to know who I like if I don't use that? Mm-hmm. Well, what about setting down the whole thing of having to know who we like?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to cherish some beings more than others? Yeah, isn't that one of the qualities we admire so much in the Buddha, is that he cherishes, Buddhas cherish everybody equally, so we don't have to worry about being thrown out of the Buddha's compassion because there's an in crowd and we're not in it. Yeah, I mean, that's a tremendous quality of the Buddha, isn't it? The Buddha has equal love and compassion for everybody, no matter how we treat a Buddha. No matter whether we believe in a Buddha or worship a Buddha or anything, yeah, Buddha has equal love and compassion. Isn't that one of the qualities that we admire that makes us feel secure? Is that we know that the Buddha's not going to play favorites? Yeah, I mean, that's an incredible quality in an enlightened being. And you can see how much it soothes our mind knowing that somebody else isn't going to play favorites. So why do we have to play favorites? And like some people and not like others. Yeah. And when we're with Buddhas, why do we still try and ingratiate ourselves and try and be their favorites if we know that they don't have any? Okay. So you see, it's like the whole structure that we've created about how we think the world operates is false. We have to take that down. So that structure that, you know, I have to like some people more than others. Why? Why do you have to like some people more than others? Why do you have to care about some people more than others?
Because
what?
Earlier you were saying, you know, the reason that we like people, that we're attached to people, is because they're kind to us.
Mm-hmm.
They give us stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and I think it's really hard for us to see how selfish and self-centered it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. You know, I like that person because they're going to give me stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And to put it that brash, sounds really not nice, and we all think we're nice.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's really quite a dilemma, you know, and as I see it more and more, I get more and more irritated. Kind of like the dilemma of the alcoholic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. It's kind of like we are here. We have just a little bit. We can see through it just enough. But yet we can't really make the decision, so we're just stuck in this, you know, place.
Mm-hmm.
Until we make that decision.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain the analogy of the alcoholic a little bit more?
Well, with the alcoholic, he's usually reached the place where he knows if he keeps on drinking, he's going to die. But if he does quit drinking, he doesn't know how to live without.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be that ego part of me. It's just, I don't know, just so frustrated. Something inside is so frustrated. You know, to see just enough to feel, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that it really involves a whole restructuring of how we see things, a whole relearning, as you said, with the alcoholic. You know, an alcoholic has to learn how to live without drink. So we have to learn how to live without that attachment. Yep. And, you know, just as an alcoholic knows, like you said, you know, that if they keep drinking, they're going to die. So they know at some level they have to change. And they know it can only be better. Yeah? But there's some fear of change. Yeah? So it's the same way with us. If we just keep on with the same patterns, we know where it's going. But we have to learn how to live without those conceptual constructs of, you know, these are the people I take refuge in forevermore who are going to kiss it and make it all better. And those are the people I hate who I'm going to throw my rat poison on. Yeah? And to realize, hey, we know that that way of living, we don't have to see the world that way. That whole mental structure of dividing the world into friends and enemies is an imputed structure that we've thrown onto things. That doesn't have to be like that. Okay.
If I could just see it now, I'm going to sit down and just go and I'm going to meditate it. My ego is going to come in and say, you know, you can get to the store and back before this works.
Yeah. So it's the thing, you know, I can imagine a Buddha living life, and of course some people may see the Buddha as enemies, but from the Buddha's side, the Buddha doesn't see them as an enemy. You know? And some many people may do harmful things towards the Buddha, but the Buddha doesn't hate them for it. Yeah. And you hear just, you know, stories from the Buddha's own life about this. You know, his cousin Devadatta. I always tell people, if you think your relatives are bad, look what Devadatta did. I mean, Devadatta was the Buddha's cousin and sent, you know, a mad elephant to chase the Buddha and trample him. Have your relatives done that? You know? and the Buddha, you know, and Devadatta had a stone, you know, a big boulder on a hill above where the Buddha was sitting and pushed it off. The boulder would crush the Buddha, you know. Okay, so it wasn't like everybody loved the Buddha. There were, you know, I mean, his own cousin hated him and was jealous of him. But from the side of the Buddha, he didn't have any feelings like that. And in fact, when Devadatta was really ill, the Buddha said what was called a statement of truth. And he said, if my affection for Devadatta is no different than my affection for anybody else, may Devadatta be healed. And he was healed. You know? So, you know, it is really showing that, you know, that the power of the Buddha could see. I mean, of course, you know, the Buddha probably didn't have, you know, make Devadatta a part of his group of the most trusted people around him. But just because he didn't do that didn't mean that he hated him and was throwing him out and he was beyond the fold of his compassion. And that's why they say that for us, even sentient beings, any kind of contact we have with the bodhisattva is beneficial in the long run. Because even if we swear at and defame and do horrible things to a bodhisattva, by the power of their bodhicitta, they're going to make a vow or a promise to lead us to liberation, lead us to enlightenment. So even though we may spend a lot of time in the hell realms because we, you know, created some negative karma, you know, in relationship to these holy beings, at the end of the day, by the power of their prayer and their determination to benefit us, because they're not excluding us from the scope of their compassion, okay, then we'll be able to attain enlightenment. Mm-hmm.
This whole issue of how the ego sort of adapts, even when we start practicing the Dharma, you know, it keeps adapting, doesn't go away. It's really interesting, you know, the practice or the verse of mind transformation, that whenever I meet a person of bad nature who's overwhelmed by negative energy and intense suffering, I'll hold such a relevant dear as if I had found her for the treasure. And I practiced that for the longest time in relation to like homeless people and, you know, people that I would meet like that seemed to me overwhelmed by negative energy and intense suffering. I mean, it took me years before I would start thinking, God, I don't see enough homeless people, you know. I mean, I can't practice that very much because, you know, I only run into a homeless person like once a week or something like that. And it took me years to realize that I run into that kind of somebody many times a day who's overwhelmed by negative energy and intense suffering, and it's me. So that was such a huge, like, it gave me the space to have compassion for myself, to realize that rather than being in denial every time I'm overwhelmed by negative energy and intense suffering, it's subtle, you know? I mean, it doesn't feel like you're being overwhelmed because you're in such denial. But it causes you to act in ways that, you know, clearly are not in your own interest. And once I was able to recognize that and start meeting that person 12 times a day, 20 times a day, or however many times I could be mindful enough to recognize that, then it allowed me to sort of stop fooling myself and, you know, it was the compassion for that state of being overwhelmed that allowed me to start working with it, you know, to start recognizing it and saying, well, you know, where is this coming from? But it's so funny, I mean, you talk about how stupid we are, how many years it took me to realize that I didn't have to wait to meet a homeless person in order to work with that verse.
Yeah. So you're saying that the verse, you know, whenever I meet a person of you know, intense suffering, great negative energy, it's referring to yourself.
Yeah, because we don't want to think that we're a person of bad nature.
Yeah.
That's not me.
Yeah, but to realize, okay, I am overwhelmed by suffering, and I'm irritated, and I'm crabby, and I'm grumpy, and I'm blaming the world, and I'm feeling sorry for myself, so let's have some compassion for me.
Yeah, and until you have that compassion, you can't work with it.
Yeah.
You'd rather just be in denial, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, me, I'm not suffering. Or, you know, we get so much into our self-pity that we can't have compassion for ourselves. So we should walk around with this little mirror when we recite the verse.
You know, and also to realize that compassion isn't, you know, your favorite chair and your Nike and your kitty cat and the pound of ice cream. You know, it's because what I do is it's like, okay, I deserve, and I think that that's being nice to myself.
Right.
We don't get that at all.
Yeah, we think compassion means self-indulgence or self-pity. Yeah, we think that's what, if we had any compassion for ourselves, we think that we would just give our ego everything we want. That's not compassion for ourselves. That's harming ourselves. Yeah? So compassion doesn't mean that you give anybody, others or ourselves, exactly what they want. Yeah, sometimes the most compassionate thing is to say, no, you need to do something else. And yes, I know this something else is challenging and might be scary and is new, but it's better for you. Yeah, because we really think compassion is, you know, karma, yeah, I'm going to catch it, make it all better. Yeah. And so like you said, you have the, you know, the half gallon of ice cream and the whatever it is. You know, the shopping center, the fridge, the credit card, and the car. Yeah, and we take refuge in those things. That, you know, compassion for ourselves doesn't mean self-indulgence like that. Yeah. Because when you think, what does compassion mean? It means wanting someone to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And I think it's interesting sometimes to think of ourselves, you know, if I met somebody who had the problems that I had, here's this other person sitting in front of me with the same attitude and the same problems as I had, what advice would I give to that person? Yeah? Well, it's usually the kind of advice I wouldn't want to hear myself. Yeah?
Yeah. If I like him, then I'm not going to like me if I tell myself that.
Yeah. Except if you really see that compassion means wishing somebody to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, then even if somebody tells us something we don't like, we can still recognize it as compassion and as recognize it as indicative of their affection for us and their care for us. Yeah. And again, pull ourselves out of this thing of saying, if somebody gives me what I want, then they're good. No, it's if somebody gives me what is helpful, then they're acting out of compassion. And, you know, it's the same thing as when we were kids. When we're sick, a lot of time we had to take medicine we didn't like. If you've ever had Tibetan medicine, we call it dirt balls. Because it tastes like dirt. It's foul tasting. Okay? But it makes you better, so you take it. Yeah. Or Claudia goes and sticks needles in you. Yeah. But you do it because it's going to make you better. Or, you know, you go to a surgeon when you have cancer because even though it's going to be painful, it's going to make it better. Yeah. So lots of times, you know, if we can look beyond the immediate experience of pain and pleasure to the result that we're trying to aim for, then even if somebody gives us advice or we give ourselves advice of something that doesn't meet our ego's likes and dislikes, if we know that it's actually going to bring about a long-term result that is better for us, then we'll follow it.
Yeah.
We want immediate pleasure at all costs. And that's why in America, they put sugar in medicine. Yeah? And so we're so used to, in our culture, the making everything taste good. That's what we want. But the thing is, if we start to practice the path, it's like the alcoholic, you know. The minute he stops drinking, he's going to feel better. It's just the fear of stopping drinking, the fear of the suffering of not drinking. The fear is what keeps us bound.
Just like the alcohol and drugs, we also crave our way of thinking. So physically, we might feel better, you know, to stop eating ice cream and smoking cigarettes and things like that. But the craving is still there. Thinking that we're immediately going to feel better if we have it.
Yeah. So the craving is what creates the suffering, not the having or the not having. And if you can look and say, I don't have, but I'm okay, then that's one way to help us get rid of the craving. Yeah. It's like, oh, I didn't eat the half gallon of ice cream, and I feel okay. Actually, I feel better. You know, so to remind ourselves, to check our own experience, and see that very often we do feel better not doing the things that make us feel bad. But we're so used to the craving and we're so used to the fear that we don't even check what our own experience is and see that we do feel better. Yeah? Because like you were saying, the habit of the craving to have the ice cream is there. So we don't even check our experience of, wow, actually, my body feels better not having eaten a half gallon of ice cream. I actually feel better. Yeah. So we don't even look at our experience because we're so involved with the craving and the fear. And I think often, and craving and fear, they go so much together. You know? Because craving, you want, and fear is, I'm afraid I won't get, I'm afraid I won't get, I'm afraid I won't get. So the craving and the fear are like their best friends. Yeah. They hold each other's hand and trot down the road together. You know? Craving and fear. Yeah, they're a very dynamic duo. And they run the show. You know? And make it so that we don't even check in with our own experience. Yeah. So we're sitting there saying, I need somebody to love me, I need somebody to love me, I need somebody to love me, I need somebody to love me so bad. And I'm afraid nobody loves me, I'm afraid nobody loves me, I'm afraid nobody loves me. And we're saying that again and again so bad that we never stop to check our experience and see that actually we're happier when we love other people. You know, not so much when they love us, but when our heart is open. Because lots of times other people love us, we can't even perceive it. You know, they say, you don't love me, you don't love me, you're just saying that. You know, so the real happiness comes when our heart is open and we care about others. Okay? But so often we don't even look at our own experience and see that. Because we're so caught in the lot, you know, in the craving and the fear and the craving and the fear.
Can you tell more about ways to break into that when you're in that place between craving and fear?
Yes.
When
craving
and our experience and how do you feel if you actually don't?
Yeah. Okay, so when craving and fear have invited you into their parlor and you've taken a seat and you're there and they've locked the door and you can't get out and you're stuck in your craving and fear and craving and fear and craving and fear. Okay. I think part of it is just to say, oh, well, thank you very much, craving and fear. It's been nice seeing you, and I'll be on my way. And lo and behold, the door's actually open. That is only your fear that said the door was closed. Yeah. But the exit door has been open the whole time. Okay. So you walk out the door, and then you say, oh, there's sunshine, and there's flowers, and there's nice things happening here. And I might not have what I'm craving, but I'm still happy. Yeah. Because actually, getting what I'm craving didn't really make me so happy, because as soon as I got it, I was afraid of losing it. Isn't it? You know, that's the whole story of craving. If I get it, if I get it, if I get it, if I get it, I'll be really happy forevermore, forevermore, forevermore. And then we get it, and then immediately it's, I'm afraid of losing it, it's going to go away, it's going to desert me, I can't trust it, it's unreliable. Right away. And we're so afraid of other people abandoning us that we abandon them first. Or we're so afraid of other people abandoning us that we're mean to them.
So they will.
So that they will go. You know? Instead of just, you know, I can be happy with what is. You know? And there's a lot of beauty in this world beside that one particular minuscule thing that I think is going to be the be all and end all. Okay, so it involves kind of sometimes experimenting a little bit, trusting a little bit? Why don't you just wiggle for a moment and then we'll have some meditation. So let's have 15-20 minutes for meditation this time, so you can, you know, really get into it. And take out some of those things that we were just talking about and contemplate them, okay?